welcome back to the Research VR Podcast, everyone, the podcast behind the science and design of virtual reality. I am your host, Oz Balabanian, and with me today are two special guests beaming in from Prague, actually. We have Dr. Doom, the co-founder and CEO of Liv. Hello, Doom.
Hello, hello.
And we have Rue, the number one player of Beat Saber in the Czech Republic, as well as the CTO of Liv. Hi, Rue.
Hey.
And if you are confused as to why there are Dr. Doom and Rue, because their alter egos have become their identities. truly, though, right?
Truly, truly. This is not a joke. Yeah. We take really serious.
Yeah, it's extremely serious. And of course, beaming in from Germany, we have Mr. Peter Luckoff.
Hello, everyone. I don't have any records to share with you, but I once ate a kilogram of ice cream at once.
Extremely relevant, but so today what we're talking about is, well, first of all, Liv, the company Liv, and what it encompasses, which is mixed reality. This is something we've talked about probably if you've listened to the podcast over the last 3 years. You've heard a lot about mixed reality. You've seen a lot of mixed reality videos and have understood at least why we think mixed reality videos are so extremely important for giving people that have never tried VR an understanding of what is going on in VR. It's a versatile tool. But before we get into that, guys, before we get into mixed reality, kind of Rue, Doom, whichever one of you wants to start first, kind of give us a little bit of the background of how you found yourself in this realm of virtual reality. Doom, let's...
Yeah?
I think, Rui, you should go first. Your story is very interesting.
Ooh, I mean... Okay, let's get started then. So it all started in a hospital in Reading, and then I was born. I existed. No, seriously, though. I just started work at a new development job at a marketing agency, and they had a VR headset in the office, and I asked if I could take it home. I did, and then instantly became addicted. Spent all of my nights for several months after that in alt space doing all sorts of crazy experiments and things like that. And eventually I got into live streaming Audio Shield on Twitch, and that turned into Liv eventually when I started doing mixed reality there. But it was just random chance that I got into VR, and I'm so glad I did. So glad.
And give people some timelines. When did you actually start? When did you get the headset home, and when did you start working on Mixtra?
Oh, man. So... I started in late 2015, probably start of 2016, really. Played Audio Shield for half a year offline. Then I started streaming it. And then November 2016 was when I first did Mixed Reality Live on Twitch, and then released the filter for everybody.
Yes.
And then February the next year, I started work on Mixtra with a dear friend of mine, Anton. And then what was it, June, July? Liv happened. So, yeah.
I think you must have been one of the earliest VR streamers. From my memory, you were probably the first streamer I saw on Twitch that was doing a actual produced mixed reality. I mean, it wasn't even just mixed reality, but one of the only VR streams that was consistently happening with Audio Shield.
Yeah, I think I was definitely the first scheduled VR stream that did mixed reality. I definitely wasn't the first person to do mixed reality. It was everybody else that inspired me to do it in the first place.
Right. Colin was, right, I believe Colin Northway with Fantastic Contraption.
Yep.
I mean, he kind of came up with that silly idea of we have a virtual camera in the scene. I wonder what would happen if we put a real camera exactly where that camera is, and then, put a 50% opacity on that top layer and see what happens. It really is an interesting, an abstract way of thinking about these things, and it clearly birthed an entire movement and companies that have come from it. So it's a cool thing that happened.
Disruption is real.
Doom, give us a little bit about yourself. How did you find yourself here?
Sure. And our story kind of ties in with Rue's story, so we'll get back to Rue in a roundabout way. But in 2016, I was still at my last company, Work Genius, and my old co-founder and a good friend of both of our six approached me. He'd been working with you on some really, really early mixed reality stuff. And you guys, along with Colin, were probably some of the first in the world to really do this and do it with the kind of quality that we see today, where it really works, right? The mixed reality aspect really works. So Six needed a place to build a cube, a green cube. Back then, it was just a bunch of cloth and tripods. And I had a big living room at the time. Thank you, Brian Chow, by the way, if you're listening to this podcast. Brian, I love you. Thank you for letting me rent out your apartment in San Francisco for way below market. I needed it at the time. But we started building the cube in my living room. And the idea back then was that I would host an esports VR show. I'm a former competitive gamer. I'm a huge nerd myself. So it just made sense for us on a hobby level. And we made a couple of videos. I think the one that really got people to sort of open their eyes up was when we did the Serious Sam video. Where we had these two Gatling guns attached to our hands.
With your Naruto hair.
With the Super Saiyan hair. Exactly. Yes. We had the Super Saiyan hair in a fat suit, an inflatable fat suit. And it just looked quirky and weird, and no one had really seen it before, even though in retrospect, the mixed reality quality that we had back then was awful. I still have all those videos, by the way, so if you want them, I'll send them your way. But we started getting approached by companies, both through Upload, back when Six was still at Upload, but also just through people who were passing through the space. And we started doing some projects, both at Upload, but also at CES, where you were as well. And we quickly kind of figured that... Well, we figured two things. One, mixed reality works really well. It really brings in everyone's eyeballs and attention to what you're doing on that big screen when they see their friend in an experience. It doesn't really matter what the experience is. It's more about the fact that there's a human in the world. So that really cuts through the noise, and we realized that pretty early. And then the other thing we realized was that it's really, really difficult to do.
I suspect that like 90% of the people listening know what mixed reality we're talking about, but just for the 10% that doesn't, can you just briefly like explain the simple process?
So the easiest way is probably to just reference one of the videos. So if you've seen a video with a real person holding Beat Saber lightsabers in their hands, slicing cubes, and it's filmed with a real camera, then that's mixed reality. And the key sort of magic there is that the real camera lines up with the virtual camera, with the virtual world. So if you're holding a weapon in game, it will look like you're holding that weapon in real life. And that's sort of where the magic really pops out. But long story short is, you know, we started to build a OBS clone that was supposed to be a one-click mixed reality solution. And at the same time, Six was looking for someone to help us build it on the tech side. And I was watching Rue on Twitch. And so Six had the brilliant idea of, hey, let's reach out to the guy who made the OBS filter. And I was talking to Rue over Twitch, and it wasn't about maybe 10 days after we'd both gone our directions on trying to sort of find someone to help us that we realized that the guy who built the filter and the guy streaming on Twitch happens to be the same person. And that was Rue. So
what kind of filter was it?
It was honestly really simple.
Explain what it was, and why we needed a filter.
Yeah, so like one of the biggest problems with mixed reality is that in order for it to work, you need to be able to composite a layer over the top of the camera, and that layer has to be transparent, and that's the tricky bit. Video game capture doesn't generally like capturing transparent things, so the solution at the time was to put the information about transparency in a different portion of the output texture, right? So you've got like this texture that has a background on it, a foreground on it, and then the foreground transparency. And it's the foreground transparency that you needed to mix together. Some people used hardware to do this. Most people composited everything in post, where you can kind of just play around with the data any way you want. But I wanted to do this real time, and the people that had done it real time had been doing it either with in-engine mixed reality, which is something entirely different. But I wanted to make it work with Audio Shield. So you had Audio Shield.
Yeah, so, sure. In fact, if I understand correctly, you can do mixed reality with OBS without your plugin. It just doesn't look that good, right? So it adds this visual fidelity where objects actually are transparent and not. And it doesn't look that fake in a sense. You kind of blend more into the object. Because can literally, without any hustle, just download OBS and try it out for yourself. It won't be perfect. But with that plugin that you used to have, and now with Live, you have basically just the visual fidelity that what was usually very hard.
Yeah, the difference...
Sorry to interrupt, but let's not forget, like, you actually have to know how to like get the game to launch in mixed reality. You have to know how to like set it up, and like how to actually set up the camera, do the offset alignment. So clearly there was like a big opportunity there to like make the process simpler, you know, rather than spending a week and a half, which is...
And a quick comment on that is there's a few experiences that even today that you can do mixed reality with without any additional work in terms of like an SDK. But regardless, there are many games, especially the newer games, the games that aren't using Unity MR standard implementation, where no matter how much you do fuckery around in OBS, you're not going to get it to output in mixed reality. Right. And I think that's what we're seeing most of our value add come in today, is that we have a really lightweight SDK for any engine.
Yeah, but I think, I would rephrase it. I think the value is that no one really wants to go back to OBS, neither the people who want to stream, neither the developers, because it just removes a lot of friction. So I don't think anyone...
It's just not an ideal. It's just not an ideal setup. Like, the benefits of doing it out of OBS is that there's no playing around with any of the blending. Like, the old methods, you would have black fringes around anything if you wanted to do it real time. And it just didn't look professional grade. If you wanted to do it professional, it had to be offline. Right. And that was no good.
So,
like,
maybe
it's no good for content.
Briefly also describe what Live is. I realize we haven't fully described what you guys are working on.
Sure. Yeah. I think zooming out, what we do at Live is we build tools for streamers to help them share their experiences. And mixed reality, and this is really important, especially as we move into worlds where mixed reality isn't the only solution. But mixed reality is a tool in a sea of tools. And it's important to look at it that way. And I know, Oz, you've made a few videos where you really explain this exceptionally well, where there are some experiences where mixed reality works really well and some where it doesn't work so well. And we have some products coming out, and we should talk about this to sort of attack that area where mixed reality doesn't work so well. But we build a set of tools for streamers and developers to help them share their VR experiences. And that's anything from mixed reality compositing to bringing feature parity from 2D streaming to VR streaming. So in HMD chat, in HMD alerts, being able to control your OBS and your streaming utilities through voice and through an HMD UI. So in many ways, think of it as long-term, at least, like a Iron Man-like HUD that allows you to sort of do your streaming in a way that's really efficient and do it well.
Nice. That's a good way to put it. Yeah, you guys are trying to essentially optimize the entire streaming experience for VR players and perhaps also the audience that's watching this on desktop or Twitch.
Maybe we should start with a history of mixed reality, and then maybe we should also then jump into more detailed process, how you would, you know, install Live and what you would do with it. Because I think it's maybe a little bit hard to grasp so far. So how did the whole mixed reality actually start? And I mean, we have here three experts on it. So maybe all of you can share your insights.
Go for it, Rue. How did you first start streaming?
That's a good question. Well, I mean, I think the first mixed reality that people saw was the Fantastic Contraption stuff.
Yeah.
Which was just some videos on Twitter, basically. And then everyone was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Or at least some people were like,
oh my God, this is amazing.
This is how you watch VR. This is how it has to be done. But then from there, it was basically just put into the, oh man. So Unity at the time didn't natively support VR. Valve released their own asset that allowed Unity to output to VR headsets. And inside that asset, they snuck in the SteamVR external camera, which is responsible for that quadrant output I was talking about earlier.
Right.
And they snuck that in because they wanted to do some filming with a bunch of games that were coming out to create like a SteamVR trailer before the headsets were even available. So by sneaking this camera in, they basically added mixed reality support to a bunch of developers' games, including Audio Shield, The Lab, Space Pirate Trainer, all of those games, Tilt Brush as well. And that's kind of where mixed reality sat for a really long time. They didn't work on it. The code was just left in there. Hmm. Loads of developers just left this stuff in there and didn't even know it existed.
Yes.
So
yeah, they're usually surprised.
It's hacked.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the crazy thing. Like, a lot of mixed reality just works. If it's an older title, it probably just works. There's still a ton of setup involved. At the time, there was, at least. So yeah, it kind of just sat there for a long time. And then we had this filter to allow live compositing that came out.
And you had also a tool for calibration, right?
That's right. There was the camera align tool. And then we also had Yaroslav, one of our engineers, who built Viva, which was the only tool on Steam that actually allowed you to calibrate a camera.
It's so good. I bought it.
And it was really good. And I used to do it by hand. Like, yeah. I used this crappy tool, and I would, like, take the headset off to check the alignment, and then I'd go back in. And it was just, like, a really long process.
So, as a fun fact, the time when I met Six was actually when I helped Six and us when I was in San Francisco with Chris, for, like, our ex-co-host. And we literally sat there for half a day setting up, you know, basically the calibration. I mean, we had literally us, who is, you know, back as a time an expert, we had like Six already did it, and like two people helping. And it was still like multiple hours setting of aligning it, figuring out what actually happens. Because you have to understand what is basically behind this whole mixed reality is like one simple file that has X, Y, Z, Z coordinates and rotation, which is basically the position of your camera and the rotation of your camera. And you track it by attaching either a Vive tracker or an Oculus controller, I think you can do two, or like a Vive controller two. And then you need to basically align the virtual and the physical camera. But the problem is that you don't only need to align them, but you need to get also the field of view right, because otherwise you have distortions. You might end up with a perfect calibration, but it's only on one plane. So it was always, you know, kind of figgling around with it.
I just remember it being this incredibly laborious process. You would get a knack for it. Like, there was a point where that crappy old tool, you could actually get pretty quick with it. Yeah. But it was like a learning process.
Mm-hmm. I remember having to draw out RX, RY, and RZ on a whiteboard to remember which what axis to rotate on and what each meant. And then having, because without a real calibration tool, you're kind of having to think of two 3D spaces at once and their relation to each other and how you rotate across. At a certain point, I remember feeling like, wow, I'm getting better at like being able to envision two different transform spaces at once and like giving directions to people that are in one space to move in a particular space so that you know they have green screen still when you rotate the camera. It's an interesting problem. Yeah.
That's why you have this nice little gimmick.
That's in the future. In the future, we're going to refer to this as the good old days.
I'm not sure
I will. I definitely prefer things the way we have them now.
So
we should say though, Viver has been a work of love from Mystery Side for a few months now. So it works really well today, but there was a long period where it wasn't excellent, and it's just been an iterative process.
It was hanging,
both figuring out where people get stuck, and a lot of it is not necessarily the calibration part itself, but just like the lead into the calibration,
right?
Or like the setting up the virtual driver versus the real driver. There's so many parts to it.
Can you explain now we're in a place. Why do you have the virtual driver? So when you install Live, to do live streaming, what it does is it offers you to install virtual drivers for a controller and a tracker. Why do you do it?
That's actually largely to do with legacy support and the fact that most users don't have a tracker or an extra controller for their camera. So the virtual camera driver in Live literally serves as a position reference for that calibration file. So when you see one of the devices active, any application that's compositing mixed reality will use that device as an anchor to apply the calibration to. It's like an offset, right? So you've got a space somewhere in your play space, and then you offset it to find the position of the camera. So that driver exists to kind of normalize all of the different quirks between old applications and new applications to try and cover it all up in a user-friendly way. There was another virtual controller driver made by, I think, Second Reality, those guys?
Yep.
And that worked really well, but it had the quirk where sometimes your controller in-game would be where the camera is, and you would have a camera in your hand, and all sorts of weird, quirky bugs like that that were really hard to explain to people.
And probably VR being a little bit sometimes a little strange behaving, right? Just a disclaimer. I mean, I'm using Live to do some mixed reality filming, and I use OBS and some other tools. I tested basically everything I could get my hands on. And honestly, sometimes I want to be angry with you, but I can't because I know it's not your fault. Mm. It's just SteamVR hanging itself for the seventh time for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Well, our software support channel for a long time was primarily SteamVR issues. became an outsourced free arm for SteamVR to do software support.
We were affected.
It's gotten very stable now.
Yeah.
So, Rue, I mean, maybe you can, the question that comes to mind is you clearly kind of figured out that there's not just mixed reality as a tool to let people see, but like the maybe you guys can talk a little bit more about like the physical element of like VR games and how you saw that kind of plugging into streaming itself. I think everyone that's on the team is pretty well physically trained and fit, and you guys seem to be really, really good at VR games, especially like the physically taxing ones. So yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. Like, you guys live and breathe, you know, for the product that you're building, and I think you guys have been one of the best players that have been out there. So you started with Audio Shield and like getting really good at that and figuring out how that fits into a streaming structure with song requests.
So like with Audio Shield is a fantastic rhythm game. It was the only one at the time, and I stand by my was. I have reasons for that.
I don't know if it's changed or anything.
Well, it's changed a lot. They used to use SoundCloud, and they replaced it with YouTube, and then they had to remove YouTube support, so now it's only local MP3 support. There's a bunch of reasons, but basically a lot of the joy has been taken out of it just due to the developer not updating it. Audio Shield was great fun. It had fantastic haptic feedback. It had lots of freedom in the range of motion that you could do, so if you wanted to feel like you were dancing, you could put some effort in and make it kind of look like dancing, which kind of made me think, well, this is kind of like DDR, right? People watch that. People like DDR. And a friend of mine on Discord, I sent some videos of like first person gameplay of this, and they were pushing me to stream this. They were like, you need to stream this game. You need to. So we kind of went back and forth on that, and we decided, yep, it needs to have song requests, because of course, everybody is going to request every Undertale and meme song ever. And yeah, they did. we set that up. And on my first stream, that person was basically downloading MP3 files for me from YouTube and dropping them into a Google Drive folder so that I didn't have to do And that worked really well. And that made for a great experience, because you would come into my stream, and I would just be rapid fire playing songs. I wasn't downloading them. I wasn't doing any of this stuff. It was all in the background. And then eventually I was like, the first person view sucks. It's too shaky. And then I started doing mixed reality. And then fast forward a bit, I got 300 hours in Audio Shields, X mods to make it harder, things like that. And then Beat Saber came around, and I was fortunate enough to try it before the game was even out.
Cool.
Because we were putting the SDK in, and holy crap, Beat Saber was amazing. Even before it came out, like before they even added bombs, like
what
they
was
had these
so amazing
water
about
droplets.
It? Like, we had an interview about whom did we do it?
It was with Jan.
Split. So we did actually an episode with Jan, and I'm still trying to understand why Beat Saber feels so amazing. I know it feels so amazing, and everyone else thinks. Is it just a dopamine hook from the physical activity, or is there more to it?
I think there's way more to it. Like, yeah. for me personally, I think there's a ton of reasons why Beat Saber feels good. And one of the smallest things that I think makes the biggest difference is something that I have not seen in any other rhythm game that I've ever played. If you are ever playing a fast part of a Beat Saber song, like where it's like da 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 da, something like that, pause the game and then just listen. You'll hear the sound effects of the cubes being hit played during the pause menu. And what that means is, in rhythm games, you can't play sound effects until the user has given an input, right? And that's a problem, because sound effects need wind up. Like when you hear a punch in a film, it's like a whoop, bam. There are two parts of the sound. There's the start and there's the end. So in Beat Saber, there's this big wind up, and then there's a big impact when you actually hit, because the sound has already started playing. It does mean that the sound isn't actually tied to the timing of your hit, which is different to every other rhythm game. But that sole thing makes the sound amazing. And I think that's a huge reason
why
it's so satisfying to play.
Split talked about that, or he briefly mentioned that they kind of play with these perceptual tricks in terms of for the user to think that they're being extremely precise, where there's actually a little bit of wiggle room for them to hit before or after the beat. But yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know that there's even a buildup to the sound effect of you slicing through, but the sound, all of that really creates this like beautiful design that is all invisible and feels like you are doing it right.
Yeah. Yeah, the key thing is that it's transparent. It's not apparent to the person when they're playing, but the sound effects in reality are like 7 seconds long.
Wow.
Like they're really long sound effects with like a second warm-up.
Wow.
It's incredible.
I think it's one of these things where there are some songs that I've heard simply through Rue playing Beat Saber where I've downloaded them afterwards because it sounded like a great song. And it sounds worse without the slicing effects.
Yeah.
The slicing effects make it feel like there's this extra bass that helps you sort of break down the music in your head. The other thing I think that a lot of people don't know about Split and Vlad and the team is these guys are excellent game developers. I mean, they've won Apple Awards in the past. So these guys didn't just wake up with VR and decide to make a VR game. Yeah. They make highly polished, really successful, at least in the past, mobile games. And they've taken all those learnings and their work in Unity to make something really exceptional in VR.
So Beat Saber comes in as like kind of, would you say, I mean, the integration of mixed reality with Beat Saber was like the kind of one of the best combinations. And it was also like probably a big break for you guys with the videos that you were producing even before Beat Saber came out, right? Maybe describe some of that. I remember viral videos on YouTube, on Twitter, on Facebook. I'm like, Jesus Christ, they won't stop with these million plus hits.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy. It's one of these learnings where you kind of realize that virality is not, it's very hard to fabricate. It kind of happens and you have to sort of respond to it. And that's what happened with the video. I think we posted it. Was it on Twitter initially, Stefan?
The $100 bills one. I think the one with Swan in it was only posted to Twitter initially. $100 bills was just posted to my YouTube and I didn't post it anywhere else. it was, none of that was planned.
Yeah, it just exploded and we obviously got a whole bunch of inbound from it, for better and for worse. So one of the things that happened was the minute Beat Saber was released, a bunch of people wanted to stream it, having seen Ruse and Swan's videos. And at the time, you know, Liv was stable-ish, but it wasn't stress tested with a bunch of people the way Beat Saber required us to do. So the first probably 3 weeks of Beat Saber being released, we were on like fire extinguishing mode all day long, Oz and Peter. You won't believe it. Like we would do shifts. It was like 5 hours of pop support just on Discord.
Jeez.
And but it doesn't feel like
Doom
changed.
Would go to the...
Like you're still very active on Discord and you're super supportive. Right.
Still super active, but it was a different time. It was a different time for sure. It was really, really hectic.
Yeah, it was like things breaking. So like the SDK launch wouldn't work. Oh. People could just not get mixed reality to work. It was like one out of two people had an issue. And also, I think it's one of these moments in retrospect where kind of like the hottest fires cast the hardest irons or something. I don't know the English expression, but don't quote me on that expression. But
the Swedish expression.
What really happened is, it's definitely either Swedish or Arabic that I'm throwing over. But if you look at our Steam page, you'll see exactly what the outcome was from us putting those hours in, which is we have 100 reviews of people telling us how helpful we are. And most of those reviews came during the Beat Saber crazy period. Hmm. So it wasn't ideal, and it definitely helped us get Liv into a spot where it's ultra stable, even though we had sort of bust ass for it. But we also got a whole bunch of community cred for it. And we've decided to sort of keep that going and just be the guys in the community that are always there willing to help and always available.
So when we stick with Beat Saber, but I mean, so Beat Saber doesn't need so much hype anymore. It's a pretty much hype game. Let's talk more about how did the process of integrating your SDK in Beat Saber went. So what is it that you provided that Beat Saber basically integrated? Was it hard? And I mean, I would assume that in the time when Beat Saber came out, you still were also not particularly polished with your SDK, right? Developed pretty
That's
much
right.
afterwards.
Yeah.
So what does Liv bring to, you know, games like Beat Saber?
So initially, our Unity SDK was still quite early. We hadn't had the time to polish it down to what developers really needed. So it wasn't the most straightforward thing. But fortunately, we had Yaroslav or Mystery working with us at the time. So he did the integration for us, and he knows the Beat Games team very well. He's worked with Jan in the past, and I believe Vlad as well. So he did the integration for them, and it's not difficult. Like if I'm commenting on what we have today as the SDK, it's not difficult at all. It is the bare minimum that you need to get set up with a couple of extra options. You drop it in, it creates the camera for you when it launches, but it only runs when Live runs. I could like walk through the README now because it's like four steps.
Yeah, it's half an hour max, to be honest.
It's really not that difficult. And there are testing instructions, of course, and obviously our Discord's always there. But really what we're bringing is the stability of our application. Like we're handling all of the bullshit of mixed reality for you. What we take from your game is just a foreground and a background. We take care of everything else. So like all you need to make sure is that your game is outputting correctly to Live. And then all of the camera support, all of the extra effects, all of like the new features that we're working on, streaming support, all of that, that's completely separate. So you'll never have to update the SDK afterwards unless we make like a really big change.
And the key thing here, one thing we've learned from a couple of folks we work with in the last couple of months is that it's one thing getting mixed reality working for your game and making a video in-house. And then there's a whole different world of getting a bunch of other people to create mixed reality. And that's really where our value is coming in now, is we've built up this really big community of streamers and creators who come to us for these tools. And then all the developer has to worry about on the distribution side is put the SDK in, and then Live handles the rest for you. So in a way, we're a really effective marketing solution for developers. And it just happens to play into our hands, which is streamers get more games to play.
But there is more, right? It's not just the mixed reality composing, but you also have like those bombs you can spawn, right, in Beat Saber and do some custom
some
things.
Secret Wait, stuff.
Really?
Is it?
I've never heard of it.
No, it's not secret.
Okay, I'll cut it out. Sorry.
Yes. So
no, it's not
so
secret. It's not secret.
It's not secret. We have streamers using it. It's going to go, this is a bit of a rabbit hole, but well, since we're already here, we should talk about it. So, you know, in the last year and a half, what we've learned is we're really effective at helping streamers and developers drive audiences and eyeballs to a YouTube channel or a Twitch channel. And so we have all these streamers who are now getting really sizable audiences, but they're still struggling with a key part of their job, which is monetizing these audiences. And so a lot of the work we're thinking about, engagement. Well, engagement is high because it's mixed reality, so it's higher than the average, like whatever stream. But it's capturing that engagement in a way that pays back to the streamer. And so we thought about a lot of ways to do it. And there's a bunch of solutions out there already for streamers in the 2D world. The way we want to do it is, well, we have already integrations with games, so that's one area where we're in that a lot of other companies in sort of monetization space aren't. And we kind of know what we would have loved to have when we streamed. And I mean, Rue is a perfect example for this because he was, you know, a really, really crazy amount of streaming happened in Rue's house. So we started thinking about what happens if we let audiences impact gameplay. You know, kind of like the Hunger Games, where you have this thing happening, this show, which a stream kind of is, right? And then you have all these audiences that are desperate to interact, but the means of interacting today are really low bandwidth and primitive, which is it's a chat window. I can write something and maybe you'll see it as a streamer. So what we started experimenting with in August 2018 is Live Game Changer API. And Rue, you should go into sort of the details here, but high level what Live Game Changer API is that it's an abstraction layer for platforms like Twitch, YouTube, and Facebook. And we provide structured data, event data. So like person X donated, person X subscribed or followed or hosted.
Right.
And then we can trigger in-game events from those streaming events. So if you're donating $10, you could give your favorite streamer a health potion to beat the boss or any other full creative freedom on how you want that to work.
That's brilliant. I mean, up until now, the only thing that existed, it was like just Streamlabs where it just pops up like a notification on your stream, which is the only real interaction that you could have with the stream itself as a viewer. I mean, this is something that I've really been thinking of. I like used to think a lot about, which is like, how do reactions of your audience go into the game itself? And it sounds like you guys are making kind of a tool for that, for developers to get creative with.
Exactly. And long-term goal there is to have an audience participation platform. So we want people to go to play.live.tv and then play along in their favorite streamers' games. And I think initially we're still going to think of it as like hosted game shows where we do it a few times a week and see how people react to it. But long term, we want people to, when they're watching a stream, if they want to interact, there should be these really meaningful and intimate ways to interact so that you can feel closer to your favorite streamer, which is all we want when we're watching a stream.
The thing that also comes to mind is you guys were also early to start thinking beyond MR, or I mean, you, like you said at Doom, where you're like, MR is a tool in your tool belt, but there's, for certain situations, it makes sense to use other, you know, perspectives. I think you guys were one of the earliest ones to start thinking about the virtual avatar and like what is called VTubers now, which is starting to get really big in Japan. You were also like doing auto switching between the camera feed. So let's say you're in an MR feed and then you're in a gun game, so you start shooting. You want to see what you're aiming down the sight, so it automatically switches to, you know, your right eye, and it's showing you what, like, when I saw little optimizations like that, I was like, this is really big. Like, this is and it takes, I think, a streamer to really know what these things are. So maybe Rue or Doom, you guys can talk a little bit about what features you started thinking about beyond the initial MR kind of help.
Yeah. So I think Doom should talk about his avatar. but I just want to like the transitionary bridge between mixed reality and like avatar reality, or whatever you want to call that. We should really have a name for that. But it was that when you're watching a VR game in mixed reality, you've gotten way more context than you've ever had for a person's input into the game. You can see their entire body, which in VR is really important. You can move your hands around. You can walk around your room. All of this stuff. Context is really important. You want to see how your favorite streamer is playing the game, right? Mm. But with a first-person shooter in mixed reality, you're not seeing the scope. Like you were saying, like you want to be able to see what you're aiming at. So like it makes sense to switch to first-person. And then also in the real world, you're restricted. You've got a fixed amount of space in your room. You can't move a physical camera around. You also can't have a second cameraman for every single stream that you do. Yeah. That's impossible. So like the only solution there is to make a fake camera, make a virtual one. And so we decided to, instead of putting a real body there, we put a fake body there. But we're using the exact same mechanism to accomplish that. We're just taking control of it in a more complete way. So like what we did initially is that we experimented with a game called Standout, and we put avatars into that. So Doom, you want to take over from here?
I mean, this is an area where I'm really passionate about, because I don't play rhythm games, but I care a lot about competitive games in general. And the games that are out in VR today that are competitive are shooting games. And I have a lot of experience in FPS games. So for me, I wanted to stream, but it just doesn't work in mixed reality. It works 10% of the time when you happen to be aligned with the view. And even then, you don't see the scope, like you said. So we found a Dr. Doom metal mask on the Unity Asset store. And then we found a green cape. And it was
from Breath of the Wild.
It was from Breath of the Wild. It was a Hyrule cape. And then we had a Live Crash Test dummy underneath. And that was okay for the moment, because at that point, avatar fidelity is just something you get, right? You don't have to worry too much about it. And we actually demoed this first for Techstars. So for Techstars demo day in October 2017, we went up on stage and we showed the avatar system. So it's been around for a long time. And we've streamed with it since early 2017, right, Drew? Or when was it?
It would have been 2017. Yeah, late 2017. It was
November
October.
Or something. October.
End of October, yeah, around that time.
And I think that's when you started popping into our streams too, Oz. Like it was back then, a big stream was 20 viewers, and we would consistently get 10 to 20, 30 viewers. Yeah. And people started asking us about how we got these tools to work. And it's a big priority for us, but then Beat Saber happened, and Beat Saber just took all our time for good. You know, we got a whole bunch out of Beat Saber, and I hope they got a whole bunch out of working with us. But now, finally, we are hopefully releasing the live avatars this month, actually.
Oh, awesome.
So Mystery is putting the final touches to it. And the goal is to release with Beat Saber mod avatars support. So if you have any of those avatars in, you can just use them off the straight off the from the get-go. And then we want to get VR chat and VRM, which is the Japanese avatar format, supported too. VR chat will depend on VR chat, and VRM is just work that we have to do.
So let's talk. I want to hear you guys' take on like VTubing and VRM. Like this really seems like it's something important that is building, and it's even so many people in the VR industry, me included, knows little about what's going on. So maybe I'm sure you guys have, you know, had more time to examine what's going on. So. Yeah, and describe to our audience, like, what is a VTuber? What are they doing? How does VR chat fit into this?
Yeah.
It's intense. I mean, VTubers for me, like, I'll be honest, I don't watch any VTube channels myself. However, I do absolutely see the appeal, and I see why it kind of became a thing. Like, we've got these creators now that can be a personality, right? But then there are some people who don't identify with a personality that is a physical person. They want to have like a cartoon character that they can attach to or whatever it is that they're into, right? So it doesn't really matter what they look like. It's as long as whoever's watching that content gets it and appreciates that character. It's not about whether or not it's real or fake. But we're only starting to see this VTuber stuff come into existence now because cheap mocap is possible thanks to VR. And people are building all these amazing tools to be able to control these avatars, both in VR chat and using VRM and virtual motion capture. And I mean, that's practically all of my context on it. Like,
but is it's like a natural evolution. Like an animoji in a sense, just basically.
It's an animoji on steroids.
Yeah.
If you want to look at
steroids. Yeah.
Lots of steroids, lots of horse steroids went into the animoji to make VRM. But I think one thing also, it's kind of cultural in the sense that it's really big in Japan right now. And it makes sense. The Japanese culture is a lot more open to things like anime and manga. So they're much more open to sort of attaching to a fake character, an animated character.
I mean, just look at Hatsune Miku.
Just look at Hatsune Miku. And there's a few VTubers in Japan right now that are growing extremely fast. We know from the Japanese VC firms that it's an area of focus for the ones that focus on gaming and VR. So there's third-party validation there too. And we've also seen people use VRM. Now, even though it's not officially supported, use VRM with Live. So people are using Live for the compositing benefits, but then plopping their own avatar in there. And a lot of what we do now is really just reacting to what people want us to build.
How does it fit into this whole new world of dances being copyrighted or not copyrightable and this whole legal fight with, you know, Fortnite? In a sense, when you have like an avatar or some animation, could you claim that it's your avatar and no one else can use it? Could you like claim that certain animations are yours? Are you seeing this coming out at some point?
That's a really interesting one. I know that I can comprehensively answer the avatar thing. I have no idea about the motion stuff because that's still kind of up in the air. Or at least it seems to be. But with avatars themselves, like the design, the visual design of that character is absolutely protectable. And in fact is by default. So like if you commission an avatar from somebody, as long as that design is not derivative of somebody else's work, that design is then an original piece of work and is protected by copyright, just like any other like original work. So the visual appearance of an avatar or the avatar's existence itself is protected exactly the same way like anything else is. So it's usable as an identity.
And let's take the Uganda knuckle, right? Who would have right to it?
It's entirely dependent on the author. Well, that's...
Yeah, I mean, is it Sonic copyright holders who could, you know, just say, stop using it? Because I think this will be very interesting if you just literally copy your famous, you know, people you really love. I don't know, just... You really love Justin Bieber, so you build yourself a Justin Bieber avatar. Can you?
No,
do
that's
it?
Fair. That's fair use. But like, I think the question would be like, what if it's a photogrammetry scan of Justin Bieber that you know he commissioned?
Well, if it's Justin Bieber, like the person, then it's not a character design, right? It's the design of a given character that is copyrightable.
Right.
Yeah, so if you were to go out and make a Goku avatar, strictly speaking, you're not allowed to sell that avatar or even distribute it because that design is copyrighted. Goku's design is copyrighted. So like when you're buying fan art, like on a shirt or something like that, and it's not distributed through the official vendor, that's actually not allowed.
Exactly.
So the same applies for avatars too. It's the same deal.
Maybe this is slightly off topic or and whatnot, and I don't know if you guys are the authority on it, but how does like VR chat work with pretty much every custom avatar is just like a famous character from whatever TV show. How does all of that work, like with the copyright for custom avatars?
In my experience with fan art specifically, just because I have a lot of artist friends, so I kind of pick up this stuff from them. Generally, the owners of these of design copyrights turn a blind eye to it. They appreciate that it's important that the community has the freedom to create what they want to create because they're passionate about the thing that they're creating. It's more important to let them be passionate and maybe lose some power on your copyright than it is to chase every single person that's drawing your character. Mm. And Blizzard faced those issues too.
But I mean, we could end up in a situation where a certain person really feels impersonated by a character. And maybe, I find it very nice to, identify myself as Justin Bieber as an example, right? And I will use this avatar, for 5 years, and I will really feel welcome, and this will be my new identity. I will be really happy in this new VR space, and then, copyright strikes in. And, some soul-crushing moments might come, right? Because we, in a sense, will be dependent on those platforms. And I don't even mean what you're building. You're basically building the means that, other vendors will support, and it's out of your hands. But we could end up in a world where our appearance in the virtual world is pretty much determined by some old legal work, right?
Well, I mean, in a way, it's kind of like the next step from your persistent profile that you have anywhere else today, right? You're just attaching an avatar to it. I think we'll see a lot more from that. And I don't understand blockchain well enough more than all the stuff that I've read on TechCrunch and all the other blogs that I follow up with. But there may be a use case here where you can more easily track ownership and maybe even break down ownership of both likenesses and meshes or avatars in that case. But we'll see what happens. Yeah. And I think for VR chat, maybe they'll eventually have that problem and they'll have the means to deal with it.
Yeah. How big is your team? Because we were speaking here about big legal firms, fighting fights in the near future, right? But, what are we talking about when we talk about Liv? How many people do you have actually who are building those tools?
In the company, how many we are? Yeah. We're four guys, four engineers. I don't code. Everyone else codes.
Mm-hmm. And how do you manage to, sustain in this world? Because some investors maybe tend to think that VR is doomed. Some don't. So
yeah. So, well, twofold. One, I have the smartest team in the world, and I keep saying this, and Rue keeps getting uncomfortable, and I'm gonna keep saying
it. Never not gonna.
I don't care, Rue. Shut up. Stop talking.
This is cute.
No, I say this to everyone, and including investors. I think investors are the ones that are most skeptical when I say it, because they probably hear that all the time. But I do genuinely believe we have the best engineers to work on the work stuff that we're working on. Minus maybe the folks at Steam VR, but they're busy with other stuff. In terms of investors, it's first of all, if an investor needs to be convinced about VR, he's probably not the right investor for a VR company. Like the gap of understanding is too big and you're already playing in losing hands. We've raised to date, so our first money, we bootstrapped until Techstars 2017, June. We did about 130,000 revenue just from services, like showing up and doing mixed reality for people. And a big shout out to Sixlist because he did most of those activations. He really pulled a huge weight back then. And then we joined Techstars. Techstars invests 120,000, and then we raised another 200,000 after Techstars. So that was about 300,000 that we pulled in January 1st, 2018. And then we just finished raising another 450,000. And with a small team of ours and where we're located in our burn, it's more than enough money to both hire and continue doing what we're doing. And then we're also looking to go out and raise again in July on the back of play.liv.tv.
And when we think about the audience of Research VR, I mean, we have definitely some passionate gamers, some passionate people who probably watch streams. But I guess some portion of it is supposed to still be, you know, researchers or engineers. How would you describe the power of Liv for, let's say, less game streaming oriented cases and more, let's say, you know, data visualization, maybe explaining stuff, tutorials, even medical, sports, right? Where do you see the power of Liv, you know, being unleashed there? And are you just not ready yet to focus completely with, you know, just for four people in a new area and you will do it at some point? Or you think, you know, some competitors will chunk up different markets and you're just, because of your passion, way more interested in gaming?
Yeah, great question. So we have a commercial license agreement for companies like yourself, actually, who are using Liv to market their products, right? And that can be anything from a defense company selling to the government and they want to show off a new simulation to an architecture firm selling houses and properties and they want to show potential customers or buyers what the place looks like and how it's sort of how you would look like inside the house or a person would look like inside a house. And we see this across the board, anything from digital marketing firms to defense companies. But that's not our main business, though. Our main business is always going to be focused around building tools and services for streamers. And in a way, the way we think about it is first help streamers do their job really well and then build services on top of those streamers to help them make money and therefore us make money.
Yeah. And to that question, Peter, I mean, I saw it recently NBC, I think it was NBC, had a little segment video that they put up where they were using Tilt Brush as a virtual whiteboard. And this wasn't on a green screen set. This was like in a studio and somewhere, wherever, and just kind of being able to paint like right in the air or bring in 3D models of things and be able to use it as a virtual whiteboard. And that really has been something that I've been trying to push for a while. And it's a kind of a byproduct that comes from like spatial computing and mixed reality. And I think that's where developers can be really clever with how they want to use this. Another thing I want to point to is, yeah, this like idea of partial mixed reality, which is like you can just, you know, let's say hold up the gun from a certain game in a video in your room, or you could use it as, again, another virtual whiteboard. What kind of interesting byproducts have you seen come out of mixed reality in general that you just hadn't predicted?
Well, Rue, I want you to hop in here, but I want to shout out to Sack, Rage Sack, if you're watching this or listening to this podcast. This is trademark Rage Sack, partial mixed reality. at least he will claim that it's his trademark.
I saw it on a YouTube video.
Oh man, he totally should too.
So Rue, explain partial mixed reality, but also explain the stuff we talked about the other week, where there's a way potentially for us to exclude game information from the texture sent to us so we can do mixed reality without having to do any background removal.
Yeah, so partial mixed reality is this concept that Sack desperately wanted us to make official back before we had the Beat Saber storm of 2018. But what it was at the time is mixed reality is three layers: background, camera, foreground. Partial mixed reality is just mixed reality without the green screen, but without any kind of background removal at all. It is a camera pointed at wherever you're playing without any of the environment of the game around you. So it's just the stuff that's really, really close to you. It's the things in your hand. It's the things that are attached to your body. It's the things in your head. And that can be really helpful on a screen.
Or with a mask? Like a still photo or a depth sensor?
Well, no. So in this context, there's actually no background removal at all. You're actually seeing the regular room.
So it looks like AR.
You're seeing virtual objects. Yeah. You're only seeing small virtual objects overlaid on top of the body. And at the time, there was like you would see some of the ground around you coming through because the way the foreground and background split works, you would cut like some of the floor too. And we had no way to know whether or not that bit of pixels is part of the floor or it's a grenade that should be on your holster. Like we have no idea. And that was the case when we had all the old mixed reality methods. But with the SDK, what you can do is you can hide all of your game's environment, all of the buildings, all of the stuff that doesn't interact with the player at all. And you just have the weapons outputting to Liv. And then that is just overlaid on top of the player. And it looks like, obviously, you're holding a weapon. So if you're streaming or something like that, it's effectively like an inventory readout. And that's what SAC, I believe, what SAC used it for Standout back in the day.
For the viewers who are listening who can't visualize it, think of it as a full body, high fidelity Snapchat filter.
Nice. Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
That's a much better way to explain.
It's AR. You're overlaying, you know, it's a normal, it looks like a video of you in a room, but with like things in your hand or things in your body, that is actually happening in a VR environment, but you have the ability of switching full immersion mode, you know, or not, depending on
actually,
your setup.
One thing that I saw Azad doing once, and sorry, Azad, for sharing your secrets.
How dare
was
you?
A drone that you built yourself. Like you took your cello and you drew in ToeBrush this weird lines around it.
Audio
you
reactive.
Beat out a green wall in ToeBrush, so you were in front of a real green wall, sitting in a throne, playing your cello while the things were moving with it. It was so amazing.
I drew myself a stage and I played cello and the stage was audio reactive because it was in ToeBrush, so the mic was feeding back into ToeBrush and the stage was lighting, was coming alive when I was playing.
I will never forget that.
That is awesome. I haven't seen that.
That's
you gotta
super
send that
cool.
Thing.
I need to see that. Yeah.
I think it was like a tiny thing like years ago, but yeah, there's
no, find the video. We need to see.
Maybe I'll think through Upload VR's archives and find early stuff. I mean, to that note, like what interesting other byproducts have you seen coming out like that?
I think there was one that SAC did recently with the Kinect.
Oh yeah.
Which I'll leave that for the end. After this one, cause that one's, like there's more to it, but I think one of the most interesting things for me that have come out of mixed reality is a drumming game called Paradiddle, and it's a really, really good VR drumming app, and that's basically all I can say about it. It has MIDI support. The developer behind it is extremely passionate about it. He plays it all the time, and he's put out these videos of him in mixed reality playing drums to the soundtrack of Whiplash. And it's freaking awesome. It's amazing. You should watch it. It's like watching a future drummer.
I mean, byproducts otherwise, Oz, is kind of like the Japanese folks using Lyft to create virtual motion captured mixed reality with an avatar. People doing foreground only mixed reality. So Servios did that video with a jazz band and then someone playing the virtual drums. Those are really the big byproducts of people using Lyft in ways that we at least hadn't prepared for or built for. But a lot of it also falls in line with the things that we know we need to build, and people are just ahead of us and they're eager to do it. And it helps us decide what we need to build and where our priorities should be.
How does the community play a role? I mean, you have a pretty big Discord that grew itself, right? What kind of role did it play?
Yeah, so this was Stefan's idea way back at Techstars. I think, Stefan, you already had your own Discord for streaming, right?
That's right. The virtually real community, which is somehow still a thing. When I started streaming, I wanted to make a Discord server for people to talk about mixed reality and how to make streaming better. It was kind of like mini Live in a way, because it's basically just evolved into the Live server. But I had a pre-existing Discord community for both my stream and virtually real.
So we back then we were using Slack for communication, and Discord is kind of like Slack. They're pretty much the same with slightly different utility tools. Discord being more angled towards gamers and Slack more towards like productivity. And the idea was that, well, if we're going to build a Slack in a community, we should probably keep all our internal communication as close to that community as possible. And I actually wrote up we've been asked quite a few times by folks on how we structure our Discord and sort of what tips we have to give other people who are structuring a Discord.
And how many people do you have now? Like it's absurdly large. Yeah.
Nearly 9,000. Yeah. Yeah. It went really big. And I've got to say, I think in 20 years or so, 10 years or so, people are going to look back at digital marketing and they're going to see that Discord and other micro communities really is the future of how to reach your audience. There's so much power that we have on this Discord. I'll give you a couple of examples. Developers, when they integrate the SDK, we usually offer to do a giveaway in the Discord channel. We have a specific giveaway channel. The last number I have that I can quote is we had about 8,300 people in Discord. We did a giveaway and the developer got over 100 inbound. Over 100 people who are going to get a free key, which is obviously people not paying for the game. But that means that at launch, you have about 100 people who are on the servers playing. This is really, really important for multiplayer games. And in general, we can type in at everyone and we can push a push notification and like a hard notification to everyone on the server. We use it very sparingly. That's part of having that power. But anytime we release a feature, we can reach the entire community really fast.
Yeah, and Rue, you were, I mean, I think my introduction to you, apart from the stream, was the virtually real Discord that you started for VR streamers. And that's where a lot of like the discussions of like how to use these tools, how to set things up really was happening. I think you're completely right, Doom, where Discord is starting to become extremely helpful for both game developers and just people with an audience to want to, rather than like getting new audiences through Discord, it's more of a way to engage with your already existing audience and for them to really feel like they have a way of like keeping up with you and reaching you beyond social media, right? Social media can be very ephemeral and very like public stagey. This is like one-on-ones. We've had a Discord for our podcast for about a year now, and it's a really good way of us having like post episode discussions, a way of like guest topic suggestions, and also like Patreon only, you know, conversations and streams. So I think, yeah, you're completely right. This is going to be looked back at it and seen as like such a powerful tool to really be able to understand who is engaging with what you're putting out and also getting the feedback that you need.
Yeah. And I'll read up a few points that I sent to a guy who reached out recently. And this might be relevant to developers and other folks who are sort of trying to grow their brand. There's a couple of things that we did early on with Discord that I think really helped us in terms of how people felt about us as a team and how people felt about our Discord as a place to go for help. And there's three things. One is you want to start early. So if you're launching a game or building a company, you don't want to think of community building as an afterthought. So if community building is your 10th hire and you're expecting someone to come in and build the community for you, you've missed the boat. It needs to be first and foremost. We've always told people that we're community first. And I think that's what's been paying dividends over time. We also used to say that for the first 1,000 or so users, make sure that when they come in, it's not an empty room. So say hi to every person who comes in. It's like a party. If you join a party and you're excited and you come in the door and there's no one there to say hi, you just feel like you're intruding someone's home. And that's how it's really, really important. We also said that moderation, if moderation is a function of your culture. So if you feel like your Discord is getting too big and too hard to moderate, then you failed at an earlier step in terms of setting a tone for what's accepted and not accepted in the Discord. And we've seen this happen on both ends. We've seen massive Discords that are totally fine like ours, and we've seen smaller Discords who have a lot of issues with moderation. And then the last and most important part is understand why people are coming to your Discord. So in our case, people come to our Discord for three reasons. They come for software support primarily. They come for hardware support. Some of them come because they've seen a video and they're just curious, but they usually don't stick around. And then they come because they know that it's a place to get early access to games through Live. We do lots of giveaways, and it's a place we can get value from being part of Live.
The main question that comes to mind is like, how do you moderate 3,000 people in a channel? How does that work? Like, how do you keep it still feeling like a coherent place where it's not every channel, you know, you go into, it says like hundreds of messages that you have to read through. Like, how do you guys handle that?
I personally think that it's entirely a function of how you present yourself. It's nothing to do with how good your moderators are. It's got nothing to do with how good your rules are. It's about how you interact with people. When somebody starts being troublesome or they're getting out of hand, talking to them and explaining to them like, this is not good and this is the reason why, usually solves the problem straight away. And if it doesn't, then you escalate and take it to a ban. But in our case, we have like two rules. Don't advertise without asking us and be polite. Right. Those are the only two rules, and we've banned like
two people.
Yeah, like two people. Like we've banned a total of two people.
And we've not had any issues at all. Like,
yeah.
We've had people who are overly passionate and they're just like all over the place. But that's been the extent of people misbehaving in our Discord. And that's not even misbehaving. That's just, you know, people are too much sometimes. You gotta take a step back.
Is there like a hinge or like a beautiful point where like this is just how many people you want to have? Anything past this is like already too many people to really feel like you're in a smaller community? Like, and I'm asking this as someone that, you know, I'm thinking about, like, what is the ideal point? Like, do I want to have more people on the channel, or does it have more value per person if it's a smaller community and you can feel like, you know, you're in a more exclusive club than, you know, being in a crowd?
I think what you said, sorry, I'm going to say one thing and then hop in. But I think what you said about quality is the key here, right? It is, if you're in a community of 1,000 people, how many of those thousands of people are really engaged and really helpful to other people? In our case, when you come to our Discord, even if we're not there, we're in Europe. So a lot of the folks are in the US and we miss them time-wise. You'll still get helped as if it was a live person, because our community is really kind, they're really caring, and they want to help other people succeed with streaming. But that's
just
not the
real
case.
Talk. Like, yeah. I want to jump in here and just be like, if anybody from our Discord is listening to this, and you better be, you guys are freaking awesome for taking care of support whilst we're not around.
Yes.
It's such a massive relief off of my mind that I can wake up in the morning and I know that there are no fires.
Yeah.
And that's awesome.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to rattle off a few names off the top of my head, like Sour Girl, Cutie Pop, Sack. We've got F-Druid. A whole bunch of people. There are way too many people to list, but you guys are freaking awesome. Keep being amazing. We love you. Seriously, we do.
I think that's a really good, that's really a result of like curating a good community, so that your main advocates are like your biggest users, and they end up being the people that can defend you in places that where you can't defend yourself, or that, you know, you're sleeping and there's a fire on and your users are the one troubleshooting. Like, that's a really good place to be.
I mean, point in case, most of our latest integrations come from the community. It makes sense too, right? If a streamer goes to a game developer and says, hey, I want to stream your game, put Liv in, they're going to listen way more than if I go and say, hey, I'm one of the guys at Liv, put our shit in. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't have the same impact at all.
Yeah, but I also think that you're in a very unique position where no one really loses anything by integrating your SDK. In a sense, if I would be a DevOps advocate, I could somewhat scrape together, a conclusion based on premises that, you know, you're kind of forcefully or not forcefully luring people into getting something and then they're stuck. The thing is, I can't make that argument really, because they're not stuck. You don't force them to use only one SDK, right? I mean, like, no game developer, I would assume, this is my question to you, like, maybe you can answer it honestly. Like, did anyone lose anything by integrating Liv into it, you know, his or her game?
So we generally get people coming in and asking for, like, they'll be having an issue with the old SteamVR external camera code. It has a conflict with ours. And this is the perfect example of what you're talking about. You can look but through the message logs. Every single time that happens, like, the easiest solution to this problem is to just delete the SteamVR external camera code. Instead, I'm giving them a fix that makes it so that it's not active at the same time as Liv, but it's not disabled. So no, we don't force people into that. We have no license agreement on the SDK or anything like that. There's no buy-in, there's no rigid.
There's no exclusivity, anything. And that's the big one. Yeah. Especially with Beat Saber, there was a lot of rumors going around and people coming into our Discord angry at us for a variety of reasons, but a lot of it being, does Beat Saber pay you? Are you paying Beat Saber? Why can't I use the standard implementation? And specifically in Beat Saber's case, it's because Jan and Vlad don't think the standard implementation is any good. Yeah. In fact, Jan and Vlad were building their own mixed reality solution. They demoed with mixed reality before Liv was even in the picture for them, and then end up using our SDK anyways.
Nice. I mean, how? Let's wrap things up with kind of like looking towards the future. What is your sense of where we are in VR today? What are you seeing coming over the next year or two? Does Quest make, you know, I mean, does that fit into the Liv ecosystem at all? And if so, how? Let's do a little bit of, I mean, I don't know about that, but like, we could just use this time to speculate a little bit and perhaps for you guys to talk about the vision of like, how does streaming go? What is streaming going to look like over the next few years?
I think on the Quest side, that what we can say is, you know, Quest or not Quest, doesn't matter what the device is. If people are going to be streaming from that device, then we need a solution. We're here to empower streamers. So that's sort of the end-all, take-all on that one. In terms of future, Ru, do you have any specific you want to talk about?
Other than maybe like I think streaming in VR is still extremely primitive. We have some really good tools. We've built StreamerKit, which is like in HMD alerts and chats. You can stay connected to your audience. And that's made a massive difference. And I know, and we've already seen the results of that. And we've done our experiments with Game Changer, and we're going to be continuing to explore that. But all of that said, we are not even anywhere close to feature parity with 2D streaming yet. Like, there is so much work to do. So VR streaming is going to be very different in a year's time, I think.
How do you see yourself in the market? Do you have like real competitors you're afraid of? Because what you just said is, you know, you're very far away from, you know, having the perfect streaming experience. Do you fear that someone will snap in and build something, or do you think that at least in the gaming area, there's just no way anyone can, you know, get there?
Oof. I mean, I don't think being afraid of a competitor is ever the right mindset. I think being aware and knowing what they're up to, absolutely. I also think one of the most consistent advice I've gotten over the years is it's unlikely that competition is going to kill your company in the first 5 or 10 years. So there's plenty of pie for everyone to explore the market, especially in VR where the pie hasn't even been baked yet. Yeah. Like, we're still cracking eggs in a bowl, you know, like there's no, we haven't even put the milk yet.
So he buys eggs.
So yeah, exactly. Like, we're not even there.
The eggs haven't hatched, guys.
Yeah, right.
And my lucky still needs to hatch an egg.
They're chasing the chicken to get the eggs.
Yeah. So that's not something we think about that way. I mean, there are companies in the VR space who are building things for streamers, like VReal, and we have Mixcast, who are also building their own mixed reality solution. And from what I know with Mixcast is their focus is more on the enterprise side, like the arcades.
The
and
UI looks also very enterprise-like. No offense.
Sure. I don't think they take it as an offense if that's their goal and target market. But that's not ours. Ours is streamers and gamers, like people like us. And again, like, I think truthfully, a lot of the folks in our Discord know us by first name, and it pays these crazy dividends when... Like, another piece of advice I always got is it's really easy to grow from a place where people love you versus having a lot of people who kind of like you. And that's what we're seeing now is a lot of our marketing is quote-unquote organic because we don't have to do it anymore. It's our community does it for us.
Yeah, and that's a really good tip for our developers listening, is that the community, rather than it, like you said, it should be something you think about from the first moment of inception, because that will end up being the flywheel that could keep your product fresh and marketing, you know, to new people without you having to spend the money to do that yourself. And I think you guys are a really good
example.
There's
a big caveat here.
Sure.
The big caveat is it traditionally only works for consumer businesses. So if you're selling to the government or enterprises, they don't care if you have a community or not. What are you going to have a community of CFOs? Like,
no,
it doesn't make any sense,
afraid,
right?
Of, to be honest, it's actually putting a lot of, I don't know what it is, but some kind of like
mandatory social interaction.
That's suspicious. It's like there's like a certain feeling that you raise with such a community with this B2B market. But I particularly, to be honest, am very skeptical regards, because it also prevents innovation going into, you know, things that we, you know, eat, live, and, you know, are being treated with. Like the food, the medicine, whatever, like every aspect, even, you know, all the machines are being built there. Like, they're also conservatives that they miss the point that the stuff needs to be fun. You know, the iPhone 1 over the BlackBerry, not because the iPhone was a better phone. The iPhone was more fun to use. And I think the same might happen with VR too, where, you know, those solutions that have like a big community that is organic, you know, it is kind of a proof that what you're doing is not necessarily completely wrong, and people have an emotional attachment to it, which in a sense would at least have a higher probability of succeeding, right? And all those old companies doing the old style business, I don't know, I'm seeing a lot of this B2B VR happening, and sometimes it's good, sometimes it's less good, but I think the biggest problem they all have is they're afraid of what you created.
You know, I should say something here, is that a company like Liv doesn't make intuitive sense for you guys to have a very active consumer facing like community. I mean, in fact, your customers aren't consumers. They're actually businesses, right? Like, these are companies, whether it's companies or streamers, like that's a very different audience than consumers. But I think it really somehow it made sense to combine a both of these, like both the streamers and your audiences, into having like a vibrant community, so that there's value to join, you know, to for a game to have live integration, and there's value for a streamer to, you know, use one tool to play multiple games, and the more games join it, the more value is created. Is that making sense?
100%, 100%, spot on. And the only other thing to add there is, oftentimes the Discord ends up being the conversion place. So people come in who aren't currently streaming VR because they saw some cool video. They realize that it's way easier than they thought it was now that we are around. And then they start streaming VR. Mm-hmm. And honestly, like if you look at our, we have a Live with Liv channel where people post their streams. There's a bunch of new names in here that are streaming consistently now that weren't streaming a month ago. And we're seeing that growth also on the usage side. So it's working. Whatever it's happening, it's working.
Rue, I have not been following the Twitch VR category for probably like a good year and a half. Like what is the current state? Like who are the biggest streamers? What are they doing? What are they playing?
Ooh, that is
are you caught up on this either?
That's a good question. I mean, so I personally don't stream anymore, or at least like I don't plan to stream in the oncoming months. So my knowledge of the biggest mixed reality streamers is purely from Liv. So I'm not sure if I'm the best person to answer that question. And I don't want to slight anybody by saying a streamer's name when there's somebody bigger or somebody who's more deserving of that title.
I'll do it. But I'll take the hit.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Let Doom take the hit.
If you guys are listening, you have no... And if someone gets upset at me, PM me on Discord, okay? But generally speaking, it's still kind of small. I think we ran some numbers. Like, how was it? 0.008% or something?
Oh, yeah, that's right. The VR progress bar.
So we track a couple of comparative numbers internally. One of them is how many people are concurrently playing the top game in 2D versus concurrently playing the top game in VR, which is Beat Saber, just to see sort of like how far away from a big pie are we really? And then also trying to get a sense of how many people are streaming VR versus streaming 2D. I think the big streamers now get like 100, 120 viewers, and we're talking native VR streamers, those that just stream VR. And there's a few names there, but RageSack is probably one of them, the guy with the Darth Maul. His stream got really big from his videos, and his YouTube has been really feeding his Twitch.
Could you explain what this number means? Because, I mean, I'm personally not that much familiar with Twitch. I know it a little bit, but maybe we have someone who doesn't know what 120 viewers is. It kind of sounds lower to a lot of people, but it is quite impressive to have that. Because, I mean, there was this famous Verge article, or maybe it wasn't famous, but I read it was like, yeah, there are a lot of people streaming for 3-4 years having zero viewers, and then at some point they get 1, 2, 3. So like this jump from 0 to 120 is like quite enormous, right?
Yeah. So, okay, I'm on the Beat Saber Twitch right now. The biggest streamer has 92 viewers right now. And I don't believe he's a VR native streamer because I haven't seen his name before. But I lost my...
And virtual reality, like the game category on Twitch right now only has 3. And like ZimTok is one that's he's been doing it for years. And the other two names I don't know.
So Beat Saber has 450 viewers right now. And that's by far the biggest VR streaming game. It's tiny, guys. We're talking like... Again, we haven't even cracked the eggs yet. That's how early it is.
Yeah,
potential to unleash.
The farm is being built. Yeah, and like right now, League of Legends has 258,000 views. Right, that's the biggest game currently. Apex Legends is 220. These are the bigger titles that clearly, if you have access to millions of players, you will be able to reach. But I guess I was asking that to kind of get a sense of like what has progressed? How has it grown over the last just few years on Twitch itself? But I mean, one of the interesting things about Apex Legends is that people started noticing that the marketing material for Apex Legends was rather than including review numbers, they were just including like, look at who is streaming our game. Like look at how many people are streaming it, how many people are watching, and who is doing it. So it's Ninja, it's PewDiePie, the
Shroud.
Shroud. this is becoming, I mean, the reason why that's important is because of it's like rhetoric by association, or like rhetoric by like reputation is becoming more important than what a number from IGN means. And I think what you guys are doing is kind of building the infrastructure for that, for especially for VR, which is still young and has a lot of room to grow.
Yeah, it's a great point. There was one thing I wanted to mention for that's going to tie into this point. Twitch is really top heavy. The top 25 streamers, 2-5 streamers, draw over 50% of the minutes watched.
Whoa!
And that behavior you'll see in VR too, just on a smaller numbers, right? So a lot of our job will be to convert the big streamers into using Live. And we're already actually seeing that. Shroud is using Live Streamer Kit.
No way.
Yeah.
That's
thank
big.
You, Sack. Hey, thank you, Raid Sack. So Sack is like our inroads to all the big streamers because they all come to him for VR streaming help.
Wow.
And he just tells everyone about Live. So
who's big Zach? Thanks to Sack. I don't think I'm familiar.
Rage Sack, the guy with the Darth Maul Beat Saber videos.
Got it.
Yeah. So
oh, I saw
where were we going with that?
PewDiePie also was using for really? Beat Saber mod video. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a fun.
That's quite that's quite a phenomenon, right? I mean, he probably got way more viewers than 120. Does it convert to more numbers?
It was YouTube videos. It wasn't a stream.
Oh, okay.
He was just uploading on YouTube.
Do you differentiate between streaming and offline video?
Yes. Huge difference.
In engagement and its reach. Like for someone who doesn't know the economy, like
it's a different content format. Rui, you can probably talk to this better than anyone.
Yeah. So like Twitch is all about everything happening in the moment. Watching a Twitch VOD is rarely interesting, but a YouTube video is inherently designed to be a standalone rewatchable piece of content. So like the goals when you're making a YouTube video are very different to your goals when you're running a Twitch stream. So in mixed reality, usually that means that the person is more focused on trying to get a good shot than they are trying to get good gameplay. Or obviously it's a balancing thing, but like with streaming, you're really focused on the audience and what's happening with the audience right now. And YouTube, not so much. You're focused on presenting the game in the right way.
Is it in a sense, could you argue that the biggest limitation of mixed reality is the fact that while I'm sitting right now on a green screen and I'm trying to film here some stuff, I need like two people, one performing and one moving the damn camera. I don't even have a good rig here. And when you're alone, you can't move the camera and, film yourself. I mean, look, me and others, or other than me, to say it more politely, try to live stream out of big screen without any mixed reality. And it was already damn difficult for two people, which, we should technically have enough mental capability to, offload a little bit here and there and just do it. But when you're like alone and you need to react to the people, there's just no way you're going to move a camera or have any friction, right? Do you see in near future streamers using like multicam setup or some kind of light field setup, whatever crazy comes to your mind? Like, it's not about your roadmap, but do you see this technology coming, or do you think it's more about, the engaging part and not so much about, moving cameras and flying shit and whatever, and like a spider camera around your room?
I think tools like that with multicam switching, I mean, that's something that we want to support in the Live app soon.
You don't do so far, right?
In general, sorry?
We kind of do.
Do you have first person? We kind of do.
It's coming. Okay. It's coming very soon. Nice.
Looking forward to it.
We are too. It's gonna be hype. We're excited. What was I talking?
You were talking about how hard it is if you need two people to do MR. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So I think the biggest changes or the biggest improvements that can be made today are on the engagement side, which is why that's what we're looking at. Things like multicam switching and increased production value and more automation so that you can be free to focus on the game that you're playing instead of trying to capture content, that sort of thing, they come later. Those are like polish points. Those are the smaller problems. There will be improvements there. It's just later. We've got much bigger things to improve on, I think.
And the way to look at it, Peter, is there's going to be a time where 3 to 5 years from now where VR streaming is really, really big. And you'll have people like Shroud who want to provide the very best spectator experience to their audience. And at that point, investing a couple of $100 or $1,000 into extra cameras and sort of setting up your stream for success is a tiny amount of work if you think about how much you're spending already today with two high-end computers and a high-end camera already, right? So it really depends on, like, you want to look at it as like, am I providing the very best spectator experience? And right now, the streamers in VR are getting the very best spectator experience with the means that they have available to them. And we're just trying to push that envelope further and further down.
You know, I mean, it's funny that you don't think, especially with the numbers where most, you know, the very, very few people that stream have most of the viewers, you think that would discourage from new people trying to get into this. But clearly, there's a lot of people wanting to start streaming to the point that there's now hardware companies that are building just very specific hardware for. So whether it's lights that is connected to your Stream Deck or just like so many hardware, like PC gaming hardware that is just for streaming. And like you wouldn't think that's a huge market to build a product for, but clearly it's growing.
Well, yeah. Interesting on that. So Superdata released a end of year review 2017. And they asked folks, and I don't remember the exact sample size, so you can look into the research yourself, but they asked folks, what's the biggest hindrance right now for you to start streaming? And over 66% of folks answered, it's really hard to start streaming. So tools that make streaming easier, and we're seeing this with the tools that are replacing OBS or making OBS easier, are kind of hot right now. So that makes a lot of sense to us. And we're trying to be in that same space too, making VR streaming easier.
And I guess we could call out or call back to the original like thing that Liv was doing was creating the green screen setup, the entire box that you need to actually have a like mixed reality and green screens was very hard. Forget the software, right? Just the hardware itself. You need to learn about how chroma keying works to even get into it. So yeah, I think you guys have had
it's
your
pain in the stomach.
Yeah.
And right now, if Six was in this call and we had Colin here too, we'd probably have the folks in the world that did this first.
Right.
First right. In the world. So if anyone's going to know how hard that was, it's you, Oz, and it's Six, and it's the folks that worked on this really, really early.
Fun days.
And Rue, especially.
Yeah. No, those were definitely fun days. yeah. Oh, man.
I enjoyed having cloth draped over my desk every time I wanted to stream.
Oh, my God. We had to do, we were doing weekly, like, Tilt Brush live streams, and
you were so stressed before it, I remember.
Dude, it's I still get, like,
oh God,
not hives, but just, like, anxiety. From remember, like the hour before going live,
the number of things
you're just freaking out. You are you're testing the battery on every single thing in the room, including like the gimbal and the camera and the microphones and the
and it never seemed to make a difference how early you started preparing.
Nope. Oh yes,
it never mattered.
Something else would go wrong.
You could start preparing 2 days in advance, but the minute it was like an hour. Until the event starts, shit starts breaking. Microphones stop working. Yeah.
I mean, back then, I remember Azad had actually two PCs. One PC was capturing or like running the application, giving it out to a second PC. I almost got a similar setup, but then I decided one PC is maybe enough. But it's quite an interesting journey that this whole mixed reality thing took with us, because like, to share maybe a small off the record story here, like one of the customers that I particularly might have talked to or might have not talked to actually is working in a company that does big machines, but for some reason they are very hyped about training VR, whatever, but he literally bought himself like a green screen, and he was like asking me questions, how to use Liv, how to do this, because he figured out that his small son, maybe 6-7 years old, was totally in love with it, whatever. But he was just literally building out of, you know, 40-50 bucks parts from Amazon, like a small tiny green screen studio just to have fun. And he was enjoying it. It was like, wow, yeah, this technology gives definitely joy to people.
Good stuff. All right, any last thoughts, guys, that you want to lay out for both like developers or like people that are really into streaming? How do you feel about where you are, and what are you excited about the future?
I have one piece of advice to give to developers. Building a community really is not difficult. The key thing is just being on top of it. When you make your Discord server, move everything there. Don't try and like check up on it once a day. It's not like the bread in the oven. You've just got to be there all the time.
You've got to
be there.
Become,
just exist in
oven.
Your own space.
Become the oven.
Become the oven.
You're going to have to love it, right? You're going to have to love your community back. Because without the honesty.
Yeah. I mean, Like, they are the most passionate people in your community. They are not somebody to be checked up on every now and again when they fall down the stairs, you know?
Yeah, and also, like, you can't fake it. So if you don't actually want to do it, don't do it. It's really important. If you fake it, it's worse. You can tell online when someone is being fake nice to you. Almost as easy as you can in real life. The only other thing is we're really excited about Game Changer API, and we want to talk to as many developers as possible who are excited about empowering their game to be both streamed just through the SDK, but also to make the streaming experience just this new and compelling thing that it can be. So if you're interested, please reach out to us. We're really easily available on Discord. Type in live.chat in your browser and you'll pop in, and then ping either me, Rue, or Mystery, or Riven, or anyone on the team, and we'll get you set up and chatting.
Yeah, if I had to put my bet on one thing that I'm excited for about the future of streaming, especially when it comes to VR, it's this game affecting API. It's that really, really can be an incredibly awesome tool for an audience member to be able to use. I can't wait to see what like games integrated and what they do with it. So let us know. We're excited to share it with our community as well, because this falls into like game design and just design.
Evangelizing the medium. In the end, I mean, look, we could argue, you know, why should we feature Live on Research VR? But I think the biggest reason why you and us were, you know, totally for it and we truly believe in this technology and mixed reality itself is it helps people understand what the medium is doing, what it's capable of. And, you know, maybe someone will start watching his favorite Twitch streamer or, you know, doing something in VR, and then, you know, Christmas comes and there is a VR headset.
I actually... My old stream community is the perfect example of this. I've probably sold 20 plus headsets, and these are people that have been in my community and told me that they've bought a headset. Recently, I got a PM from a community member, Subtracticat, who has just started using Live, and he was one of my first viewers.
Nice.
Which is awesome, because the guy didn't even have VR before.
It's crazy.
So he's like fully converted and is now doing what I was doing, which is... Yeah,
you're kind of adding the social part to this medium that everyone was expecting, right? Everyone was, yeah, VR is social, which it is, you know, VR chat and stuff. Yeah, VR gaming is social, but now you kind of make it easier to share this experience with someone without a headset, right?
Mm.
Well, it's a hard issue, right? You're converting a 3D world into a 2D screen where people are watching. And one thing that a friend of mine who works at Oculus told me yesterday on a call was, it's really helpful to think about VR as screens and spaces. Screens and environments. And if you start thinking about VR as screens and environments, then you realize really quickly that you need to compress this 3D experience into a 2D screen, mm-hmm. even if you're watching it in the headset for now. I mean, eventually you have volumetric capture, and you can put the volumetric capture into the headset and you can sort of be in the room with them. And we're absolutely thinking about that already. We have a couple of Kinects in the office that we're experimenting with.
But problem as long is as we you need can... something better than the Kinect. The Kinect itself is an amazing device, but
the current version of the Kinect. Well, wait for the new one. Yeah, I think you'll be surprised.
Yeah. I'm waiting.
But we need to convert a 3D space into a 2D space, and mixed reality ends up being the best tool for that right now.
Yeah, well put. I also think of drones in a very similar way. It's like you have a 3D space and you have a 2D screen, and that drone can be anywhere and you can move it in any shape. So if you want to convey the sense of depth or like great sense of how big a place is, it's all about how you move it and where you place that 2D screen in a 3D world. So yeah,
Can I give a shout out?
Sure. Yeah.
I want to give a shout out to Oz the Wizard, because Oz the Wizard has been doing some crazy, crazy drone and photography.
Stop.
Honestly, man, I gotta say that picture—it's
really impressive.
Yeah, check Oz's YouTube channel. The one you did recently on Reddit that had like 11,000 upvotes was amazing. That was the Star Wars. Not the Tatooine.
It wasn't Tatooine, actually. I found the kind of one of the first spots where it, like, R2-D2 lands in episode 4 and like walks around on the dunes. Hmm. I was there for a capture trip and David Fincevar was like, dude, that's where they filmed it. And I like took a shot by shot of like where R2-D2 had landed and like where I was. And it was like 1-to-1. But
it was identical. It was
cool.
Like clearly you were there, which is amazing. So good shit. I've been following your stuff ever since like over a year ago. And it keep getting extra surprised every time.
I appreciate it. There's some fun. I'm making a big move to somewhere far. So I'll talk more about what that means soon and what that means for photogrammetry.
That's awesome. Anyway, we'll see you more.
No self-promotion on this channel, guys. Not for me. how can people find out more about you, for you two specifically, and find out more about Liv? Like Twitter handles and whatnot.
So we're at Liv everywhere. Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. That's really easy. Liv.chat in your browser to join the Discord. I actually got a Twitter recently, but I don't use it. I hate Twitter, so don't add me on Twitter. just come into our Discord and chat.
Yeah, and I will send you ice cream.
Discord is the place to be. Come play games with us.
Yeah, come play games with us. If you really want to contact me anywhere, it's Ruirize literally everywhere. Just Google that. Ruirize. Reach out to me on whatever's easiest for you.
Cool. All right, you can find the Research VR podcast on Twitter at ResearchVRcast. And if you find that this podcast is giving you value, at least value on a monthly basis that is worth the $2 that we have on Patreon, consider supporting us on Patreon for as little as $2, which is half a cup of coffee in San Francisco.
Or one tiny ice cream.
You just gained 2 subscribers. I didn't know you guys had a Patreon.
We do.
But I'm putting my dollars in
tiny.
There. Thank you, VC money. You're getting VC money back into Patreon.
Yeah, economy.
We actually just hit like 20 patrons, and I'm going to do a stream on Sunday, which is a little bit late for this for podcast listeners. But yeah, if you're following along on Patreon, I'm sending a link out there. Yeah, it's small. It's just a good way of like keeping engaged with people that want to help support us. And we have a few unreleased stuff that we haven't given to our patrons yet, but we will. Some rambling
what
thoughts.
What will come will shock you.
From what will come, number 7 will shock you. All right. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Rue. Thank you, Rue and Doom, for joining us. This has been a great episode.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, guys. And much appreciated.
Thank you all for listening. Goodbye.